Okay, let's get started here. We're moving on to the type of skepticism that I called populist skepticism, and our main focus for discussion today will be Thomas Paine. Before we get into that, let's remind ourselves what this movement looks like. It's largely an American and English phenomenon. It was originally deistic, so people like Paine himself were deists. But later, largely atheistic. So, by the time we get to the later stages of Richard Carlyle and Robert Ingersoll, we will have out and out atheism, also Charles Bradlaugh. What characterizes populist atheism, what distinguishes it from the atheism and skepticism that we'll be looking at in the next section on Strauss and in the Tübingen School, is that there is a certain coarseness of tone, and there's little or no scholarship. These people are not trained scholars. They haven't gone to university for the most part. They haven't achieved a degree. They have little familiarity with the material, and they sometimes make rather spectacular blunders. They have no interest in maintaining an urbane tone. They're not detached like John Stuart Mill. They are not earnest and tender like Matthew Arnold can be. They are blatant coarse. They have no compunction about saying things that will disturb the feelings of their more delicate readers. This literature is directed largely at the working class. That's not to say that's the only place that it has an impact. But as we'll see, Tom Paine's work was actually printed up in small paper pamphlets in segments that could be made available very cheaply so that workers could afford to purchase a bit of it, and then among them they could put them together and have the whole thing. It was instantly popular among the working classes and caused the Orthodox clergy a considerable amount of grief and trouble as they found that within the scope of their parishes there were people who were defecting to this form of infidelity without any apparent equal way of their reaching them. They had difficulty operating on the popular level. We'll see toward the end of today's lecture one way that someone tried to handle that. But this kind of skepticism also became very popular on university campuses. It was wildly popular with undergraduates at Yale just before the year 1800. And we have this documented in some of Lyman Beecher's work, and we'll take a look at that as well in today's lecture. This is not a chronologically isolated period. This is a type of skepticism that crops up over and over. So we'll see Tom Paine writing in France for consumption both in England and in America, Richard Carlyle in England, Ethan Allen in the United States, Bradlaugh in England, Ingersoll in the United States, George Holyoake. These kinds of skeptics. Some of them members of the London Skeptical Society, others just well known. Tammany Hall on the United States side was a gathering place for many of these kinds of critics. They keep cropping up, and it's a very popular movement today. Actually, the kind of skepticism that you see in Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris, though it has a scientific edge to it, is often nothing more than a rewarming and reserving of arguments brought forward by the populist skeptics, and in fact, sometimes they don't even do as well as their populist predecessors. There are some recurring themes here. I want to focus on some methodological issues. If we're concerned with the question of the types of special divine action that are front and center in the Christian evidences, the questions of miracle and prophecy, then these come to us for the most part reported, and the religiously most significant ones of them are reported at quite a distance in time for us now. So there are methodological issues that are critical. How do we determine the authorship of an ancient work? What do we do when we have multiple accounts of what appears to be the same event, and there are discrepancies in narratives and in testimony? What is the strength or the weakness of arguments from silence? How do they work? When are they powerful? When are they weak? These methodological issues we will see coming up not only here in the Populist Skeptics, but again in our consideration of Strauss and the Bauer and the Tübingen School. These issues will be vital issues. The difference is in the way that they're handling them. They're handled by the populists with a flick of the wrist and offhandness, but handled by the more scientific skeptics, skeptics who want themselves to be scholarly, critical, in a manner that brings in more footnotes, more references. You'll find very few footnotes and references in the work of Paine, as you already know now, having looked through it. So let's meet our man, Thomas Paine, English-American political activist, born in England, very active pamphleteer in the American Revolution. Somebody has described him as a corset maker by trade, a journalist by profession, and a propagandist by inclination, and that sounds about right. He narrowly escaped death in Paris. During the French Revolution, he was actually imprisoned by the French, and he was marked for execution. But there's a curious story about this. It appears that Paine and his cellmates put it out that Paine was very ill and needed to have air, fresh air. And so they had multiple levels of security in the jail, and they let him leave open the door of his cell so that more air could come in. Well, somebody came around marking the doors where people were to be executed, and when he found the door of the cell where Paine and his cellmates were kept, he consulted his list and put a large chalk mark on the inside of the door, which was standing open. Paine and his friends rapidly realized what that chalk mark meant, and so that night they closed the cell door. When the executioners came through to pull prisoners out to execute them, they looked for the chalk marks on the door, didn't see one because now all they saw was the outside of that door, and went past Paine's cell a few days later. Robespierre was taken to the guillotine and a new government was put in place. James Monroe secured Paine's release. Paine was, at this point, very anti-English, though he had himself been born in England. He wrote for the French press, telling them how they might use gunboats going down the coast of England in order to subjugate the English. But the work that he had just finished, actually passed off as he was on his way to prison, was the manuscript of his Age of Reason. And the two parts of this, part one published in 1793, part two in 1794, caused a considerable scandal and lost him the friendship of some of the other movers and shakers in the American Revolution. He became very embittered. He thought that George Washington had conspired to have him imprisoned. This is highly improbable, but Paine lived out the rest of his days a very angry and isolated man. Broad outlines of his attack in The Age of Reason Part 2, the one that I'm having you read, because that's the one where he says at the beginning that he has obtained, between writing parts one and two, a copy of the Bible, which he finds is a much worse book than he thought it was. So that tells you how much primary source research he did for The Age of Reason Part One. But in Part Two, he tries to make up for it. Here are some of the principal lines of attack. First of all, the historical books of the Old and New Testaments were not written by their traditional authors, and we can tell this by internal evidence. We can look at the internal contents of the works and determine that they were not written by the people to whom they are traditionally ascribed. This fact, he then goes on to say, destroys their credibility. If they weren't written by the people whose names they bear, then you can't trust what's in them. They attribute morally evil things to God, and in particular, the slaughter of the Canaanites, and in still more particular, the slaughter of Canaanite infants. That is repugnant. Paine is a deist. He believes that there is a God. But that God is a good God, not a malicious one. Maybe good and relatively disinterested, but certainly not morally evil. And he would have had to be to have ordered the slaughter of the Canaanites. Therefore, the Bible is a wicked misrepresentation of the deity. But more importantly, the books contradict one another extensively. They relay the same events in different terms. Some omit events that others contain, and according to Payne, this is a contradiction by silence. Their omission of certain things is, in effect, they're saying that the authors knew nothing of those events. So by this technique of assimilating silence to contradiction, he is able greatly to inflate the number of contradictions that he has to work with. We'll touch on a few examples as we move forward. There was an immediate reaction to Payne by several people. One person of great interest for us is William Paley, because Paley, of course, is the author of A View of the Evidences of Christianity, also published in the mid-1790s. This is a very important piece of work by someone who has done some scholarly homework, and he's aware of what Payne is writing. And here's what he says, apparently in a bit of correspondence. I've seen some short quotations from Tom Paine's works in newspapers, etc. I should not expect from him much close reasoning upon the subject. I agree in thinking his talents for writing are respectable and his impudence unbounded. If there be anything in my work which should happen to meet his objections, I shall account it fortunate. I think no good is done by a reply, which would only unavoidably disseminate his poison. So Paley took the point of view that Paine was not worth a direct response. That would only draw attention to him. He deserves all the neglect that we can give him. There's an interesting note in an autobiography of Lyman Beecher, who was a student at Yale in the 1790s when Paine's works came out. And speaking of the fall of 1795, he writes, "That was the day of the infidelity of the Tom Paine school. Boys that dressed flax in the barn, as I used to, read Tom Paine and believed him. I read and fought him all the way. Never had any propensity to infidelity, but most of the other class before me were infidels and called each other Voltaire, Rousseau, D'Alembert, etc., etc." So Yale University had been thoroughly infected by Paine's brand of populist skepticism. It's interesting because the kinds of arguments that Paine is making, though he's making them coarsely and with rude asides in his sentences, are some of the arguments that we still hear very commonly today. This was a problem more than two centuries ago at Yale. Which brings us to Timothy Dwight. Timothy Dwight IV, grandson of Jonathan Edwards, a Massachusetts state legislator, theologian, educator, chaplain during the American Revolutionary War, songwriter, congregationalist minister. He was a child prodigy. He was reading the Bible at the age of 3. He graduated from Yale at the age of 17. Became the 8th president of Yale in 1795. Note the timeline. Okay, Paine's works have come out in 1793, 1794. Lyman Beecher says that in 1795, this was distressingly prevalent at Yale. He, having graduated from Yale, having kept contact with Yale, and then being brought in as its 8th president, gave an address in 1793, which he published the following year, called A Discourse on the Genuineness and Authenticity of the New Testament. That should now be in the database. John, were you able to get the links to that?
I think so.
Okay. And also another one, The Nature and Danger of Infidel Philosophy. Again, this is an address delivered a bit earlier and published in 1799. That was an address actually given to the graduating class at the time. Dwight instituted a series of lectures on the historical trustworthiness of the New Testament, and he invited all of the undergraduates at Yale to bring the best objections they could, and they hashed them all out in those lectures, and the effect was that Paine's influence was vastly diminished, and Yale University was, at least for the time, returned to its original standing as a training school founded by Christians and for the propagation of Christianity, among other things. Now back to England for a moment. Richard Carlyle, born in 1790, was a tinsmith by trade, a freethinker, a publisher, and a political radical. He got hold of Tom Paine's works and reissued them a bit at a time in small, cheap paper editions so that working men could pick them up a bit at a time, make their way through them and imbibe Paine's opinion of Christianity. He went to jail several times, including in 1819 for reprinting Paine's Age of Reason and some other stuff. He was convicted of blasphemy. The attorney, I believe it was Erskine, who convicted him, was, paradoxically, a great defender of the freedom of the press. But he turned prosecutor in Paine's case, claimed that Paine had overstepped all bounds of decency and, in fact, had tripped across the blasphemy laws. So Paine was jailed, originally sent to jail for a short period of time, just a few years, but then immediately upon his release, he was jailed again. While he was in jail, his wife took up the publishing business. When his wife was sent to jail, his sister took it up. So they kept these things going. Not just free-thinking work of the deistic or atheistic variety, but also political radicalism. And political radicalism is going to be a strand that we'll see weaving in and out of the free thought movement throughout this entire period. When he got out of jail, he teamed up with the former Reverend Robert Taylor, who was known as the Devil's Chaplain. You may notice that that is now the title of a book by Richard Dawkins, and went on what they called the Infidel Home Missionary Tour. This is a very interesting phenomenon. Taylor was an early advocate of the mythic theory, and in his Diegesis is one of his works, which should come up in the database fairly shortly. John will find it and put it up. The Diegesis by Robert Taylor was a book arguing that Christianity was a ripoff of pagan mythology. So when you see the Zeitgeist movie these days up on YouTube, or you read internet websites, you'll find that this is now very popular among rank and file atheists today. Richard Carrier is probably the best known among the contemporary mythicists, he and Robert Price. There has always been a trickle of this since the late 1790s or so, and Carlyle was a promoter of this idea that there never was a Jesus, that the whole thing was a mistake, a misunderstanding. The 12 apostles were really just names for the 12 signs of the zodiac. This all had to do with the sun and various mythologies that centered on the sun. As an interesting side note, the mythic theory became the official position in the Soviet Union early in the 20th century. There was a German mythicist named Arthur Drews, D-R-E-W-S, looks like Drews, but pronounced Drews. And Drews' books were circulated in Russia. The propaganda machine got to work, and they would actually send party functionaries out to public meetings to use Arthur Drews' mythicist arguments to embarrass and confound the ministers, the Christian ministers in the Soviet Union. So that was, for a while, official Soviet policy. And that brings us now to Richard Watson, also born in 1737, several of our key people were. And Watson, although he didn't like to engage in ongoing public discussion of his own works, as you know from having read the very end of his Apology for the Bible, he did say that he loved to come forward in a moment of danger. He had done that with Gibbon. Now he comes forward to respond to The Age of Reason Part 2 by Paine. Now, you'll have noticed that his style with Gibbon is very polite. He's careful not to attribute bad motives to Gibbon. He treats him with respect due to a man of learning. Paine, he clearly has a much lower opinion of Paine and of his work, and so he is more than willing to take on a somewhat chiding tone in various places as he's going through it. Paine is just exasperating. Paine is crass. Paine is a boor. And Watson doesn't mind telling him so. So here are some major issues in Watson's critique of Paine. First of all, he makes a distinction between authenticity and genuineness. Authenticity is substantial truthfulness. It does not require the exact precision of every detail. It does not even require that the author be free from the occasional slip or blunder. It does require that the main outlines of what is told be right. Substantial truthfulness is to be distinguished from genuineness, that is, the authorship by the person to whom it's traditionally ascribed. Now, he thinks that the genuineness of most of the historical books of both the Old and the New Testament can be perfectly well established. However, the credibility of what they report does not, in most cases, depend on their genuineness. And so he's careful to make that distinction at the outset. If you look at Paley's view of the evidences of Christianity, you will see that Paley also makes this distinction. Second major point, substantial truthfulness is not undermined by an occasional error or unresolved discrepancy. Otherwise, almost all history, ancient history certainly, but even some modern history, would collapse. This is an important point because it's something that's going to be brought up again against Strauss and Bauer and the Tübingen scholars. Most of the Anglican writers of this time, not all, but most of them, are not concerned to defend a view of inspiration that absolutely forbids there to be any small error in matters of detail. Instead, their objective is to show that the broad outlines of it are substantially true and well authenticated, and that all we need can be shown to be historically sound and justifiable. If there is a minor slip here or there, it is just that. It's minor. It doesn't affect the overall strength of the argument. Third, a large number of the errors that Paine charges upon the Bible are, in fact, products of careless or ignorant or uncharitable reading. Man can't read, doesn't know the background, falls into crass errors, and then impudently attacks other people for having made what he thinks are small errors and says that all the credit of their work is destroyed by that. Well, says Watson at one point, if you think that Luke was one of the apostles or claimed to be an eyewitness, then you are unfit to write about these subjects. You are ignorant. And by your own rule, we should dismiss everything that you've written. I think that would be silly. I'm not going to do that. But by your own criteria, you are undermined. Let's look more particularly at the two major kinds of argument. The argument from prophecy is the first. Now, Paine is going to attack that, and it's very interesting to look at his attack in connection with the work of Anthony Collins. Collins had written a book called A Discourse of the Grounds and Reasons of the Christian Religion in 1724, and last year when we did the Deist Controversy, we looked at that book in some detail and some responses to it. Collins says that the New Testament stands or falls with the question of whether the Old Testament prophecies were fulfilled. If they are to be taken literally, then they are not fulfilled. Therefore, we must read them in a figurative manner, drawing on the work of the Church Father Origen for some of the more fanciful figurative interpretations. Woolston also pushed a line something like this in his Six Discourses. But Paine's argument here strongly recalls the work of Anthony Collins. Watson doesn't concede anything. He says the evidence that Jesus was the promised Messiah is perfectly good. However, the claim that he was a prophet from God is a separate claim from the claim that he was the Messiah. Both may be substantiated, but they're different claims, and they have different grounds. He is more interested in the question of whether Jesus was a prophet sent from God, and therefore he doesn't give an elaborate treatment of the argument for prophecy, though he avows his complete trust that this argument can be vindicated. So you would have to go back into some of the earlier works, most notably a couple of books by Edward Chandler, which give a defense of Christianity from the prophecies of the Old Testament. So that's a major part of the Deist controversy. Watson says, I don't think you're right there, but what I need to establish here is that Jesus was a prophet sent from God, and that can be established on the basis of his miracles alone. So he quotes a couple of passages. You may have noticed in passing that Watson was quoting some things from John 3 and John 10, where Jesus says, believe me for the very sake of the works that I do. if for nothing else. The works that I do testify of me. Nicodemus says in John 3, Rabbi, we know you're a teacher sent from God, for no one can do these mighty works that you do unless God is with him. So Watson wants to rest the case on the miracles, though he gives his formal declaration of his complete trust in the argument for prophecy as well. In the course of writing this critique, Payne makes a comment that the Christian faith, and in particular the Old Testament, is built on heathen mythology. Watson says, briefly, that's a groundless claim. You could, with more justice, try to maintain the opposite, that the heathen mythologies are derived from the Old Testament. Doesn't go into any details on that. But today, again, one form that mythicism often takes is to attempt to say that the Christian religion is a rehash of pagan mythology. Another form that it takes is to say that the Christian religion is a rehash of elements of the Old Testament. When we get to Strauss, we'll have a look at how he does that, particularly in Strauss's treatment of where the story of John the Baptist came from. So I'll be assigning that. I know it says selections for reading in the Strauss selection of the syllabus. You'll see that I'll assign some specific passages about that for you to read, among other things. Here's Payne on the argument from contradictions and discrepancies, direct quotation from the edition of Age of Reason that we have up on the site for you, pages 155 to 56. I lay it down as a position that cannot be controverted. First, that the agreement of all the parts of a story does not prove that story to be true, because the parts may agree and the whole may be false. Secondly, that the disagreement of the parts of a story proves that the whole cannot be true. The agreement does not prove truth, but the disagreement proves falsehood positively. That has a plausible ring to it. But it turns out that it's ambiguous. It's ambiguous on the phrase, the whole cannot be true. One way of taking that phrase is to say, the whole thing is false. Another way of taking it is to say, not every single assertion in the whole of it is true. There must be at least one that is mistaken. Watson's reply to this is interesting. He clearly views the question of whether there are some trivial discrepancies in the narratives, some contradictions regarding peripheral matters, as a low-stakes game. He's not invested in anything that might today be called the doctrine of inerrancy. He thinks that just doesn't much matter. He does think it matters a great deal whether they're filled with contradictions, hundreds of them, all throughout the narratives. That would be a real blow to the trustworthiness of the narratives. But here's how he responds to what Payne has said. I think it is scarcely possible for even two persons, and the difficulty is increased if there are more than two, to write the history of the life of any one of their acquaintance without there being a considerable difference between them with respect to the number and order of the incidents of his life. Some things will be omitted by one and mentioned by the other. Some things will be briefly touched by one, and the same things will be circumstantially detailed by the other. The same things which are mentioned in the same way by them both may not be mentioned as having happened exactly at the same point of time, with other possible and probable differences. But these real or apparent difficulties in minute circumstances will not invalidate their testimony as to the material transactions of his life. Much less will they render the whole of it a fable. If several independent witnesses of fair character should agree in all the parts of a story in testifying, for instance, that a murder or a robbery was committed at a particular time, in a particular place, and by a certain individual, every court of justice in the world would admit the fact, notwithstanding the abstract possibility of the whole being false. This from the Two Apologies, pages 298 to 99. Now, you will remember that at the beginning of letter 8, Watson gives a quotation from Payne, where Payne says, if the writers of these books had gone into any court of justice to prove an alibi and had given their evidence in the same contradictory manner as it is here given, they would have been in danger of having their ears cropped for perjury and would have justly deserved it. This may be a reference backward to a book by Thomas Sherlock, which we studied last year in the Deus Controversy course, called The Trial of the Witnesses of the Resurrection. Sherlock's trial, which is in the database, takes the form of a mock trial carried out by several gentlemen of the court, in which one of them has been reading the works of Woolston and Collins and wants to try to bring a charge of perjury against the disciples. The other, the protagonist of the Trial of the Witnesses, undertakes to defend them, and in so doing engages with the arguments of Woolston and of Collins. And the work was wildly popular, went through so many editions that there's even been some uncertainty as to the date of its writing. Was it 1728, 1729? Sherlock's work drew a criticism from Peter Annett, and Annett was in turn answered both by Charles Moss, and then in a work which I believe Moss and Sherlock collaborated on. So there was some back and forth on this, and it looks plausible that Payne is here picking up on that, though he doesn't name Sherlock or Annett, and in turn Watson doesn't name them, but there is a possible pattern match there, and that's something that you could go and have a look at. While we're speaking of pattern matches, let me just regress for a moment, talking about Watson's response to Payne's charge that the Old Testament portrays God as vengeful, vindictive, and wicked for having ordered the slaughter of the Canaanites. Watson's reply to this is a fairly standard reply, neither less nor more convincing than it has been laid out in other people's works from the same time period. Paley, for example, has a sermon to the same effect. His reply, though he doesn't name Joseph Butler in the Analogy of Religion, is exactly in line with Butler's Analogy of Religion. This comes up, I believe, in the first letter of the Apology for the Bible. And you'll remember, not far into it, 6 or 8 pages into it, Butler has the following quotation. "I am far from being guilty of the impiety of questioning," this is Watson now, but echoing Butler, "I'm far from being guilty of the impiety of questioning the existence of the moral justice of God, as proved either by natural or revealed religion. What I contend for is shortly this, that you have no right in fairness of reasoning to urge any apparent deviation from moral justice as an argument against revealed religion, because you do not urge an equally apparent deviation from it as an argument against natural religion. You reject the former and admit the latter, without adverting that as to your objection, they must stand or fall together. If God can permit innocent people, yes, even smiling or crying infants, to be swallowed up in an earthquake or killed by a tsunami or lost at sea and drowned, then in the course of nature already, God permits such things to happen. And you, Payne, as a deist, do not say that proves God to be wicked. Why then, if more particularly God ordains the death of smiling or crying infants at the hands of his people with their swords, why is that an impugnment of the justice of God any more than God's allowing them to die in the course of nature?" There's an analogy between revelation and nature, and if we pay attention to that and we acknowledge that there's an author of nature, we have no ground for saying that there is not an author of revelation. That argument is, of course, a two-edged sword. Pretty early in the 19th century, the response to Butler became, yes, just so. They stand or fall together, therefore let's be atheists. Let's deny the goodness of both the author of Scripture and the author of nature. Let's say that if there were one, he would have to be not the God of classical theism, not even the more personal God of popular theism, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who is supposed to be good and merciful and just. He would have to be either morally wicked or limited in power, like Plato's demiurge from the Timaeus, who, with the best will in the world, simply can't make material nature come together the right way. It's recalcitrant. It resists his attempts to to make it come out right. Okay, back to pain on discrepancies. In this case, specifically in the narratives of the resurrection, obviously this is the central miracle claim of the Christian religion, and therefore pain directs attention to that. Here are a couple of examples of what he has to say about discrepancies in the narrative. From page 164 of Pain, the book of Matthew continues its account that at the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn towards the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulchre. Mark says it was sunrising, and John says it was dark. Luke says it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and other women that came to the sepulchre, and John says that Mary Magdalene came alone. So well do they agree about their first evidence. Now, Watson's reply, he doesn't even bother to try to go any further than just to say this. All the evangelists agree as to the day on which they went. And as to the time of day, it was early in the morning. What court of justice in the world would set aside this evidence as insufficient to substantiate the fact of the women's having gone to the sepulchre because the witnesses differed as to the degree of twilight which lighted them on their way? This is truly a trivial discrepancy. And so Watson says you're manufacturing this because they're using different words. One says they arose early while it was dark. Another says that it was dawning. Another says it was morning. Come on. It's no doubt going to take them a little while even just to get from Jerusalem to the place outside of Jerusalem where the tombs are. The sun was at the point of rising. This is not a disagreement that should in any way undermine the credit of the narratives. In fact, it's an interesting point that in the middle of the 19th century, Thomas Starkey, who was a lawyer, not a theologian, wrote a practical treatise on the law of evidence. And in his practical treatise on the law of evidence, Starkey argues that small disagreements and even actual contradictions among the witness rarely disturb the credibility of their testimony as to the principal facts they're relating. And Starkey goes on to say, if they were to tell the same story in the same words, that would actually undermine their credibility because it would lead us to believe that there was some kind of concerted effort to get up a story among them to make sure that it came out in the same words, talking points, as we would say today. And Starkey, at that point in his practical treatise, actually gives a quotation. He says, a great observer has noted that the ordinary character of human testimony is substantial truthfulness under circumstantial variety. If you look up that phrase, if you do a search for that phrase, you will find, and in a footnote, in fact, he tells you, that it comes from William Paley's view of the evidences of Christianity. So Starkey, the legal theorist, writing about the law of evidence and testimony in court, talking about discrepancies, actually quotes Paley as a great observer, as in fact Paley was. Paley liked to go to the courts and watch lawyers argue their cases, and you can tell as you read his evidences of Christianity that his mind has been shaped by long observation of arguments in legal trials. Again, there is, says Watson, no disagreement of evidence with respect to the persons who went to the sepulchre. John states that Mary Magdalene went to the sepulchre, but he does not state, as you make him state, that Mary Magdalene went alone. She might, for anything you have proved, or can be proved to the contrary, have been accompanied by all the women mentioned by Luke. Is it an unusual thing to distinguish by name a principal person going on a visit or an embassy without mentioning his subordinate attendants? Again, the rules we would use if we were reading anything else, any other kind of account, the life of Boswell's Life of Johnson, or somebody else's Life of Johnson, or comparing them, or even comparing the works of Voltaire about certain historical epochs with the works of others who have written about the same things, we're going to notice small variations, stresses, someone named, someone not named. He might have gone further here. He might have noted that in John chapter 20, as Mary is relating the absence of the body to Peter and to John, she says, they have taken away the Lord, and we do not know where they have put him, speaking in the plural, indicating that although the narrative has just told about her coming and then her running, there were other people with her as well. So there's actually evidence in the text that Watson might have noted, but does not, that John is not trying to tell us that Mary came alone. Here's Watson on the argument from silence. He says, the other books you observe, that is the other Gospels, say nothing about what Matthew does, this application of the chief priests to Pilate asking for a watch to guard the tomb of Jesus, or about the sealing of the stone. And according to these accounts, there were none. Now, Watson quotes that and says, this, sir, I deny. The other books do not say that there were none of these things. How often must I repeat that omissions are not contradictions, nor silence concerning a fact a denial of it? If you go back through this edition, the two apologies, you'll see that Watson makes this point to Gibbon once on page 148, and besides this bit on 320, you'll also see similar comments on 312, etc. I've given you some references there that you can chase down if this issue is something that interests you. A bit later in the 19th century, there will be much discussion of points like this. Richard Whateley, the Oxford logician and eventually the Archbishop of Dublin for the Anglican Church, in 1819 wrote a spoof called Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte. It's a very famous piece. And in it, he takes up the skepticism of Hume and the mode of argument of popular skepticism of the time, in particular making use of arguments from silence, arguments from incredulity, why the things that Napoleon is said to have done are really rather incredible, why should we believe this, let's all be good Humeans and disbelieve them because they are incredible antecedently. And so his spoof, Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte, is designed to show the silliness of arguing in this manner. Indeed, he comes to the conclusion that Napoleon probably never existed as a historic person, but was a useful fiction contrived perhaps by the British government as a means of inducing national unity against the French. That kind of spoof is popular. There's one by Charles Hudson, Doubts Concerning the Battle of Bunker's Hill. That's also something that we would have in the database. If it's not in there already, I'll get John on it right away. And later, the Abraham Lincoln myth by Oliver Price Bugel, which I will try to incorporate into some of the readings for one of the later modules, especially on Tubing and Skepticism, just because it's so absolutely lovely, arguing from the standpoint of the fourth millennium that there probably never was an Abraham Lincoln. All right, that'll take us far enough for today.